Well, I'm probably going to, those of you who have been here when I've been here before know that I might tend to move kind of fast, and I'm probably going to do that again this morning with these passages. I want to talk to you a little bit about the idea of covenant. And but before I really begin that, let me just clarify for you, when I'm talking about covenant, there's another word that is synonymous with covenant and conveys a really important aspect of covenant between people and God, and that word is treaty. Treaty. And so I'm sure that that word has a lot of connotations for all of you. I'm not going to go into, and I'm not going to really spend any time defining that for you now, but I think that if you keep that word in mind, it'll be helpful to you as we look at these passages this morning. I don't know how familiar you are, how much of Abram's story, his life story, you might recall. Before this Genesis 15 passage, he's been around in Genesis for three previous chapters, from chapter 12 on. When God calls him. And it's not like I want to go over some of his story because it's just so crazy. I know that we think of Abraham as being the father of our faith, and he is. And in some ways, I think that we hold people up on pedestals. I want us to have a real clear picture of why a treaty is necessary, why a treaty is chosen by God, why a covenant is established by God, and then the nature of that covenant. So here you go. Here's Abram in just a few minutes. He's originally from Ur, which is way down the Euphrates River. And at some point, during the first 75 years of his life, after he's married to Sarah, he winds up moving to Haran, which is a strategically located city in what is now southern Turkey. Haran was also the name of one of Abram's brothers, along with Nahor. And they were all three of them. Abram, Haran, and Nahor were sons of a guy named Terah. And it was a wealthy but troubled family. Haran, Abram's brother Haran, is the father of Lot and Milcah. We're going to take the heat down on this a little bit. Good, because I get a little amped up. And so... Sorry, good. I probably don't even need it. Haran is one of Abram's brothers, along with Nahor, and Haran, then, is the father of Lot, Abram's nephew, whose wife later turns to a pillar of salt and all that. You're familiar with that. And Milcah. Now, get a load of this. Milcah married her father's brother, Nahor. Okay, so she marries her uncle. Haran, I find a lot of this really funny in a lot of ways. Haran ends up dying in Ur. I like to think that it was because of embarrassment of his daughter marrying his brother. But maybe it was in a duel with his brother over. I don't know, but all this has got to be a little bit upsetting, right? Nahor isn't mentioned anywhere else, probably because of the incestuous marriage. That's what I'm guessing a little bit. They, of course, didn't know about the things that we know about now, but still, actually, I'm taking a risk with sharing this with you, but the whole incestuous thing is something that's real close to my heart. In fact, my favorite bumper sticker is this: help stamp out inbreeding, ban country music. No, I'm just kidding. I'm sorry about that. Okay, so... You gotta admit it's funny, even if you love country music, right? Okay. Terah wants to leave town. So he takes, that's the dad now, Terah takes his son Abram, Sarah, and Lot with them to Haran. Terah apparently was a pretty savvy businessman because the family became wealthy while they're in Haran. And then Terah dies there at the age of 205. All right? Pretty old dude. So he did pretty well for himself. God speaks to Abram to start walking, and at the age of 75, Abram goes. He doesn't really know exactly where he's going. He just knows that he's going to know when he gets there, when he sees there. He leaves his home and starts walking generally south. Probably thought that if, I'm guessing, if he thought that he had to move, he might as well move to a warmer climate, right? And that's what most of us do. And, but then, actually, of course, God ends up showing Abram where to go. At the beginning of chapter 12, God promises Abram that he's going to make of him a great nation. Now, Abram's already a pretty old dude, and it seems kind of unlikely that that would happen, but that's the promise God makes. And based on that promise, Abram goes. When he arrives in Canaan, God says, yeah, this is the spot. And so Abram kind of marks his territory there by building an altar. Then a famine comes, and things aren't so great. And Abram says, well, you know, it's dry, it's hot, and all this other stuff. And Abram's probably going something like, I don't really understand why people live in places like this in Arizona. I think I'd like to find a place where there's moisture and stuff could actually grow. So he decides that he's going to leave again. So Abraham and Sarah and Lot, they head for Egypt to escape this famine, because they're not all that thrilled with the spot that God showed them. Apparently, he lost trust at that point. Then when they're getting close to Egypt, then they encounter some other people, and Abram gets scared that he might be killed because Sarah is so beautiful. I like to say she's hot with two T's. Sarah is so beautiful that Abram is scared that these people are going to kill him in order to have her. So he lies and says, she's not my wife, she's my sister. You can have her. That's what he does. Fortunately, God looks out for both of them, protects them both. They decide, these other guys decide that they're not going to take advantage of that situation. And Pharaoh even gives him all his stuff, lets him head back to Canaan and all of that. So Abraham's back on track. He calls on God, and he starts to act like he knows that he's somebody who's loved and cared for by God and all of that. He allows, get a load of this, when they get to Canaan, he lets Lot choose where he wants to live. He lets him choose his real estate. Instead of Abram doing it, because he was the one that would have had the authority to do that, he defers to his nephew. That's pretty good, isn't it? That I think that just shows a lot of trust and confidence in who he is and the position that he's in his life. It's really rare. Only somebody who's really confident in their own status and well-being can do something like that, can let go of something like that. But in one of the worst real estate decisions ever, Lot decides to move to Sodom. Did not work out very well for him. Abram is left to move to Hebron. Lot ends up being taken captive by the armies of the kings who, I mean, all this bad stuff goes on. Abram risks his own life to save Lot and all his stuff, returns a hero, is blessed by the priest Melchizedek, and Abram even acts righteously with all the spoils of the battle, gives a tithe to Melchizedek and proper shares to all the others that are with him. So he's doing pretty well. I mean, he comes from this really seedy background, and he's kind of back and forth some, but at this point, he's doing really well. But then, after all of this, after God has shown his favor and protected him and Sarah and their stuff and Lot and all these other things, then Abram starts to question his status with God again. So he starts to whine. And God makes his promise again to Abram, that he's going to have a great reward, that he's going to be made into a great nation. And the wealthy Abram says, well, what are you going to give me since I don't have any kids? You know, somebody in my household, nobody special, just somebody in my household is going to get on my stuff. There's not going to be anybody to carry on the family name. He's all worried about this. And God promises again, not only are you going to be a dad, but your family is going to end up huge. Just remember, God wants Abram to remember everything that I've already done to get you to this point. Abram believes God's promise again. You see, he's here. He believes the promise again, which God counts as righteousness. And yet Abram asks again for proof. How do I know that this is really going to happen? So God has, this is really bizarre. So hang in here for a minute. God has Abram go get a number of different animals, certain animals he instructs him. Abram goes and gets those animals, kills them, and cuts their carcasses in two, and lays them out split carcasses, like on either side of this carpet, on the aisle. The two halves of each carcass, one half of each carcass, is on each side. You see? So there's this, like, I don't even know how to describe that, like a slaughterhouse gauntlet sort of thing that's laid out on the ground there. Now, in this Genesis 15 passage, here's what happens. God comes to Abram as transcendent darkness. You've probably never heard that phrase before, have you? It's not a phrase that we would normally say. It's a really unusual thing that happens here. In fact, this word that is translated darkness in our English Bibles is used only in this place. It's not used any other spot. God comes to Abram as darkness. This awesome in the truest sense, not the teenager sense. In the truest sense, God comes to Abram as awesome, even terrifying darkness, and enfolds him in it, envelops him in it. This is a really, really intense picture. It's God coming as darkness. Commentators suggest that God came as this darkness to enhance Abram's awe of God's power. God does this sort of thing often with people. Like he wants to remind them that he is really powerful. Now, he does it in different ways. In this case with Abram, he's doing it as darkness. There was another time with Moses later on in Exodus when Moses is leading the people and things are, you know how the Israelites were at that point. They're in the wilderness. They're out of Egypt, and they do all these crazy things, and they keep wanting to forsake God and go back and all that stuff. And one night, God puts on this fireworks display from Mount Sinai. Thunder and smoke and lightning and fire and all that kind of stuff. And the people are going, because God had invited everybody to go to the mountain to be with him. And the people are going, too big for us. Moses, you go and you come back and tell us what he said. And later on, God says to Moses, where is everybody? You know, why didn't they come? And Moses tells them, and God says, they completely misunderstood this display of my power. I was trying to show them that I am that powerful that I have the power to help keep them from sinning. And they completely misunderstood. God is showing Abram his power, trying to show him the greatness of his power to both make and keep his promise. God was making Abram an incredible promise. He's already an old man. And God is telling him that he's going to be a father of a great nation, huge, beyond number, he says. He's making an incredible promise. God wants Abram to know this unbridled power that he possesses so that Abram will know that God has both the power to make and the power to keep that promise. Because Abram's having a problem with this. Up and down, in and out, right? All the time. And then later on in that same Genesis 15 passage, it says that darkness falls. This is a different word for darkness than the first one. First one was kashika. This is alata. Completely different words, right? I'm only telling you that because you can tell. There's no relationship between them. Completely different words. This word also is used only in this spot. Now, you could get out your concordance and find the word darkness, the English word darkness, translated in many places. But these two, only in this spot. Isn't that interesting? It is really interesting to me. Something really incredibly special was going on here. And it just means to cover, like to maybe even to shelter, like to It's a darkness that covers. In the darkness of that moment, God is giving Abram grace so that he will understand this treaty that he is about to make with him. This is the moment. You want to find out what a word means, like covenant? This is how you do it. You go to the first place it's used. This is the first spot. And in this moment, God uses this darkness to highlight his presence in those symbols. The torch and all that, you know, that goes down through the dead carcasses of the animals. This bizarre thing. It sounds so weird, right? But let me tell you that the people at that time understood exactly what God was doing with this. This was like making a visible treaty. Something. This is like signing in blood. Or, you know, a blood brothers thing. I mean, you're sealing this with blood. In fact, this was God. It was God's presence going down this slaughterhouse gauntlet. This bizarre scene. And God is saying, may this and even worse be done to me if I don't keep my covenant. There are not many settings in my life in which I would say such a thing to anybody. How about you? Like, put yourself on the line like that. This is God, the creator of the universe, the one that holds everything together by his word and his power. This God who has revealed his incredible power in so many ways. And in this moment to Abram, in coming in this all-enveloping, awe-inspiring, jaw-dropping power, and that God lowers himself to say, to walk through those animals in the form of those symbols and say, you see these dead animals on either side here? You see how they're split in two, how their blood has been poured out? May this be done, or even worse, to me, if I don't keep my promise. Whoa. This God is taking this very seriously. This was the, hear these words really carefully. This was the maker of the covenant, making himself responsible for its keeping. He didn't make it contingent on how well Abram did he? In fact, Abram continued to have struggles, as we know, further down the road. I mean, there's the whole Hagar incident, and, you know, so he's... I mean, there's a lot of stuff still in the future for Abram. But God is telling Abram, I'm putting myself on the line for this. I'll keep it, even when you can't. In fact, interesting to me, Paul, in his letter to Timothy, he's got this hymn that goes on there, and he's talking about some of his attributes. And at the end, Paul writes, and it was a song that he was writing. You can see by the form that it's in. At the very last couplet in that song is that even when we are faithless, God is faithful because he cannot deny himself. Right there, right here it is. The very beginning of that Paul even understood. Thousands of years later, God is making himself responsible for the keeping of the covenant. Now, the truth is that I do exactly the same kind of thing that Abram did. Don't you? I mean, the up and down thing and the trust and the not trust and I'm not so sure and, oh yeah, I'm all in and then I'm back out. And it's like we're doing the hokey pokey sometimes, right? I mean, it's just that's the way I am. Maybe, probably all of you are. You're all in all the time. But me, I tend to be up and down a lot. So I do this. I waffle between courageous belief and a yes, God sort of life. But between that and despair and isolation and doubt and all that kind of stuff. Part of this is because, well, I know myself and I'm not so sure that I'm sure that God wants all of you in the covenant. Not so sure about myself sometimes. So, I mean, I just think that's part of it. But the thing that I need, that what Abram needed, what and he was asking for, what I need so much, what we all need so much, is security. And sometimes, like Abram, we try to do that through control. It's a really bad idea. The Hagar thing, not so great. The, oh, she's my sister, you can have her thing, not so great. Right? I mean, we try to do it through control. But the antidote for our need, our desperate need for security, is not control, it's trust. And God is trying to communicate to Abram his power so that Abram can trust, that he will actually keep the covenant. God took the responsibility out of Abram's hands and took responsibility for both sides of the covenant. I'm going to keep my side and I'm going to keep yours even when you can't. Well, but in spite of the fact that God took that responsibility off Abram, took the weight off. I mean, we see it again and again and again. In spite of the fact that God took that weight off me and off you, he still invites us to live in it, to live in that covenant, to live with the same kind of devotion to that, with the same kind of intense desire to fulfill it that he has. It's got everything to do with trust and with intimacy. By the way, that second darkness has to do with imminence or intimacy. Being close, being near. That's what God was doing. He came near to Abram in that moment. And he wants to do that in such a way that we live in the covenant together with him. That's what this whole process is about. So you jump to, how does that look in real life? Well, here's one way, and we're going to stick with Abraham for a minute in that Genesis 22 passage. It's very familiar to most people. God tells Abram, take your son to Moriah, and you're going to sacrifice him there, this son that you love so much. The fulfillment of the promise that I gave you back in first in Genesis 12, and then I sealed it with the covenant, with the treaty that I established, with walking between all those dead animals and putting my own life, my own self, my own integrity, my own blood on the line. I want you to take that very son, and I want you to take him up on Moriah, and I want you to sacrifice him to me there. And Abram leaves. Now, here's the thing that I really want you to get out of that passage. There's a moment when Isaac, it dawns on Isaac what's really going on here. Isaac is not like a toddler or something here. He's a relatively grown young man, probably late teens, maybe even around 20. Enough so, like this strapping young man who, he's the one that Abraham loads up with the wood for the fire on which he's going to burn him. And the light is dawning on Isaac, and he's getting nervous. Like they're going along, he sees the place. He tells everybody else, stay here. It's just going to be me and Isaac, the fire and the wood and the knife. And they continue walking on the path. And Isaac realizes he is the closest thing to a lamb around. And so the way the text reads is Isaac says, Father. And Abram says, here I am. Just like he had said to God at the very beginning of the passage, by the way. And like he says to God at the end of this passage, when he's got the knife raised in the air. Abram just keeps saying, here I am. I'm here. Isaac says, Father. Abram says, here I am. And Isaac says, well, we have the fire and we have the wood, but where's the lamb for the sacrifice? And of course, Abram famously says, God himself will provide the lamb. I heard a messianic Jewish guy teach about this verse one time, and he said, it's probably been 25 years ago, I've never forgotten this. It was so powerful to me. He said, the Jewish rabbis that have written about this attach a connotation to Isaac's plea to his father. And by plea, I just mean his father. The connotation is the idea behind it that the Hebrew people understood was that Isaac was saying, "Daddy, I long for your smell." Isn't that weird? "Daddy, I long for your smell." When my kids were little, every one of them went through a phase where, I'm sure others have gone through this too, where they were insecure at night and sleeping, and so they would end up coming into our room and climbing up in bed with my wife and me, and there they'd sleep, you know, until morning. Lynn would get up. My wife is an early riser, and she'd get up early and kind of quietly get out of bed, and within a couple of minutes, whichever kid it was would wake up. And she'd say, "You know, I think they can smell when I'm gone." Do you get it? Isaac was saying, "I see what's going on here. I see what's coming at the end of this road. I see what's about to happen here. And I, it's not that I'm not willing to go, but Dad, if I'm going to do this with you, I have to know you're near. I have to be able to smell you. It's got to be like I'm in bed with you early in the morning. If I don't have that smell, I'm not going to be able to go through with this. This walking in this covenant thing is just a little too much for me right now. But I'm willing to try only if I can smell that you're near." God invited Abraham and Isaac to walk in the covenant that he himself had both made and committed himself to keep, but he invited them to be part of it. They were walking that out on the road to Moriah that day. And they were, I'm sure Abraham must have been scared out of his mind too, probably trying to keep it together for his kid, right? That's what I'd do. Trying not to just freak out. We got robbed once. Somebody broke into our house, robbed us. Everybody in my house was freaked out the next night. Hard getting everybody in bed. Once they got into bed, I was free to freak out, but not until. Abraham must have felt something like that. Like, I got to keep it together for my kid here. But this is God inviting them to intimacy in the covenant. Inviting them both. And Isaac is willing to live in it too. Abraham obviously is willing because he's going there. He's got the knife. He raises it up to plunge it into his son. Isaac is willing to go because, believe me, by this time, Abraham's probably 120, 125 years old. He is not holding Isaac if Isaac doesn't want to be held. He's not keeping him from breaking away. That is not happening. Isaac is cooperating, and they are both in the dark again. That covering, enveloping, awe-inspiring darkness, and they stay. This table, this altar that Abraham found to place his son on, it's a type of table. Stone. Rough. But it's a type of table. See, you see, God always invites the people of the covenant to come to the table. To live in it. To come and be at the table with Him. The darkness. The intimacy. You know, there are, outside of marriage, very few things in life are as intimate as sitting at a table for a meal with somebody. There's a lot of trust and intimacy involved in that. God is inviting them to this closeness, this intimacy, this imminence. It's the place of the invitation to live in and under the terms of the covenant, even though God has given the assurance that He will not bail on the covenant, even if we do. God asks our yes to live in the covenant with Him, but He does not renege His promise if we say no. He just keeps inviting us to the table over and over and over so we can learn to trust, even, maybe even especially, in the darkness. Today, God calls your name and mine and invites us to the table. He hasn't changed. He's always dealt with human beings on the basis of grace. It's always been that way. The one who makes the law takes responsibility for the power to keep it. The one who makes the promises takes the responsibility for fulfilling the promises. The one who initiates the covenant also puts his own life on the line. Do those words sound familiar? Do they ring a bell with anybody at all? He puts his own life on the line to see that that covenant is never broken. Never. You think about the last table at which Jesus sat, and how he invited his disciples there. They were in the dark. They did not know what was going on. Some of them were afraid. Certainly later in the night, all of them were scared out of their minds. Jesus invited them to this table. He's trying to show them what he's been trying to teach them for the last 3.5 years, and they're still in the dark. He invites them to the table and he tries to explain what he's going to go through, and they just don't get it. They're still in the dark. They're still on the path to Moriah. He tries to teach them how they ought to relate to one another. In fact, how he has been relating to them by getting on his hands and knees and washing their feet and instructing them to do the same. And they just can't quite get it. They're still in the dark. But he invites them to the table of his imminence, his intimacy, the place where relationship happens, the place where the covenant is lived into, where we practice it, where we learn to live in the same way as that God who lays out the carcasses and walks between them and says, I will give everything to keep this promise to you. Nothing will deter me from it. Nothing. And Jesus invited them to the same kind of table. The Father brought the Son there on the threshold of his own self-sacrifice. The Son invited his friends of that covenant to the same table. It's got to do with trust. It's got to do with yes. It's got to do with devotion. It's got to do with self-sacrifice. It's got to do with living in the covenant, knowing that God is both its maker and its keeper. He is, in the words of the writer of Hebrews, the author and the finisher. And we are invited to learn to live in it. From the treaty to the table at Moriah, to the treaty again. From the treaty to the table in the upper room, to the treaty again. From the treaty passed on to each one of us, and to this table this morning, we are invited to learn to live according to that treaty with the one who established it, laid his life on the line so that it would never be broken.